In just a few moments, 9 of Uncle Sam's most powerful bombers will sweep out of the southeast in 2 separate flights, one at an altitude of 4,000 feet and the other at 15,000 feet, in simulated attack on military objectives in this vicinity. This attack will be the climax of the most intensive aerial maneuvers ever undertaken by the United States Army Air Corps. From our vantage point here at the Seversky Field, the Air Defense Headquarters of the 3rd Wing, under the command of Brigadier General Frederick L. Martin, a special features division of the Neutral Network, will bring you a description of the exciting events which are to take place in the next few minutes. From the Defense Headquarters on the ground, and from the giant bombers themselves, Mutual will show peacetime America how the civilian population can cooperate with the military in defense against enemy air raids.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
And I'm Dean Karyanis. Welcome back to the Angry History Show.
Yes, welcome back indeed. In May of 1938, as the world crept closer to another global conflict, the United States was busy preparing its military and its people for the possibility of attack from above.
The Army and its Air Corps, predecessor to the Air Force, mounted 4 days of war games in Farmingdale, New York, out on Long Island, to test the ground response to a mock bombing run on the Seversky Aircraft Factory, a likely industrial target if war came to America. The enemy would be represented in the air by 3 twin-engine Douglas bombers with their bellies camouflaged to make them tougher to spot from the ground.
Yeah, and as important to the Army as how the ground units respond is how the civilian population of the area would deal with this whole thing, especially since a regional blackout would be part of the operation.
Yeah, thousands of flyers were passed out around Farmingdale, giving residents the heads up and asking them to do their bit. And it's good to remember that there's war going on in the rest of the world at this point, and they mentioned that a little bit in the report. You know, there's a civil war in Spain, there's a war and invasion of China by Japan. So people really would have been aware this was going on. So even though we tend to think of when America entered the war here, there was a war going on already. So I imagine this was sobering to get this flyer that ended with the plea, quote, "Please cooperate with your War Department, city, state, and county officials to make this, the first American blackout, 100% successful."
It is, but you know what, Dean? In my mind, I hear Chappie reading that. Why don't you read it again like Chappie for me? Come on, go ahead.
The flyers ended with the following plea. "Please cooperate with your War Department, city, state, and county officials to make this, the first American blackout, 100% successful."
Thank you. I like that.
That's probably how they were reading it in their head at the time, right?
Well, that's exactly. Anyway, the test was scheduled to run from 10:30 p.m. to 11 p.m., and WOR radio was there, and they did a great job of covering the event from the ground and the air.
A half mile away, the town of Farmingdale is a blaze of light, which, although in the center of a rich farming area, in time of war would be a strategic military focal point for air raids because of 2 great aircraft factories which border this field. However, at the first sound of the approaching enemy air fleet, sirens atop the firehouse in Farmingdale and the nearby New York State College of Agriculture will shriek a warning to the entire population. The citizens have been drilling for this maneuver and been drilled by officers from the nearby General Headquarters Air Force Base at Mitchell Field, and will immediately extinguish their lights, plunging the circular area within a diameter of 5 miles into complete darkness in an endeavor to save from destruction these 2 factories which manufacture planes for our Air Corps. During the maneuver, Farmingdale will be defended by the 36th Pursuit Squadron of the 3rd Wing. 9 of these planes are now resting on the field before us, and at the sound of the warning siren, they will take to the air from this inky black field with nothing but the light of the moon to guide the pilots. Across the field, searchlight and anti-aircraft batteries of the 62nd Coast Artillery are in readiness to go into action to repel the invading air fleet. The scene, therefore, at Air Defense Headquarters is one of tense and watchful waiting. And a half mile away, quiet civilian population goes into its usual, unusual evening activity.
He's got this classic sort of, you know, old-time radio guy voice, much like our boy Chappie, but we don't have his name, nor do we have the name of the man who was in the bomber. We'll hear it a little bit later. You know, if we have the information, we give it to you, but in this instance, hard time tracking this guy down, but he did a great job. It's just so interesting. You know, he talks about, you know, going into their unusual evening activity. It's like being told to turn all your lights off. I mean, that's got to be, it really must have been upsetting to the populace to an extent, because we really hadn't had to do this before. And when you're altering your sort of, you know, your habitat to such a degree, it's got to be upsetting. You know, in addition to Farmingdale, the blackout area included parts of Bethpage State Park, south and east Farmingdale, and parts of North Massapequa.
Yeah, this was really virgin territory for an America still at peace, still 3.5 years away from Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
The power company was going to handle killing the street and road lights via master switch, but residents were expected and reminded to turn off their own lights.
That's right. According to the book Aviation in the U.S. Army, 1919 to 1939, the decision to let residents control their own juice during the drill came from mistakes learned in England, where the government would take the whole grid offline and, like, you'd have doctors in the middle of operations say, you know, suddenly without power. So they wanted to avoid that.
Yeah, that never worked in MASH when they had to operate by candlelight. Or remember when Klinger brought in all the Jeeps to use the headlights? That's not the way that you want to be operated on. So I think the people probably, with the power, they weren't as dependent on the power either as we were now. So I think now that might be a hard thing to do, because I don't know how much people would be able to comply, and not to mention our obsessive compulsive needing to be on the computer, needing to have the TV on. So it's interesting that at the time they were probably a little bit more primitive, for lack of a better word, just by the technology of the day. You could turn the lights off and they probably were okay with that.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I bet you had you had some battery-operated radios and such. But, yeah, I think, you know, even you talk about today and cyber attacks and things like that, EMPs, things that sort of are being, you know, talked about creeping into our sort of fear zone. I mean, there would be mayhem if people couldn't, you know, log on, or people couldn't, you know, constantly check their device or things like that. I mean, talk about what a psychological assault that would be to not have power today in the way that we're used to. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, you see it when it happens now. We have some of these natural disasters, big storms, knock out power. It's hard for us to even conceive of not having those devices when we need them. When you have a blackout, how many times do you go and hit the switch, right, when you go to the bathroom, even though you know that it's out? You expect the little magic man in there with his hamster on a wheel to be providing the power. Yeah. It's not. You know, it doesn't just come out of the holes, obviously.
Now, it's funny, though. You know, it reminds me about that. You know, Bill Hughes and I were in in Walker's a few months ago in New York, and we just met up in the afternoon. We're going to have a couple of beers and just talk about a couple of things we're going to work on. And, you know, I know a handful of guys in there, and all of a sudden I'm looking at all these guys and they're checking their phones, and I hear like this hushed whispering start. And next thing you know, people are half freaking out. And there had just been a terrorist attack someplace in the world, and people are freaking out because all of a sudden half the people in the bar couldn't get on their devices. And it was some sort of localized Verizon outage. But, like, you could just see there was a bit of fear creeping in. Like, you know, they were asking, like, the guys, you know, the big tough guys, hey, Owen, you know, can you get your, can you get on your phone? What's going on? It was just a strange little kind of thing to notice, that a slice of what could happen if big things did go down. But anyway, go ahead.
So back in 1938, we're back on Long Island. Plainclothes cops, uniformed officers, volunteer firemen, and American Legionnaires patrolled the streets to help folks turn their lights off and prevent crimes in the dark.
Yeah, there's got to be a lot of opportunism there, you'd expect, you know. And most of this is going to come out in the archival audio, but we want to break down quickly the sides and their objectives in this drill.
Yep, the central factory building is Team Black, the enemy's main objective on which it hopes to drop the theoretical 600-pound bombs. And by the way, if the idea of an attack on Long Island seems far-fetched or paranoid or war jitters, remember the Nazi Operation Pastorius in the Hamptons, where a Nazi U-boat did shoot ashore some Nazi saboteurs, and they planned to hit some Jewish-owned business and generally cause havoc. And, of course, the Black Tom explosion in Jersey City. If you go to Liberty State Park there, right by Ellis Island, right near the Statue of Liberty, the explosion damaged the Statue of Liberty, this munitions factory. They heard it as far away as Maryland, which is a long way away. And so this was a real fear that there could be an attack on Long Island.
Yeah, and the Amagansett operation, it was such a in its way, a hilarious misadventure, you know, which ended up with a bunch of dead Nazis. But this story's been told often. We'll probably get to it someday because there's some fun angles we could have with it. But okay, so when the warning signals go off, in this case, the warning signals to the area were three fire department siren blasts, okay? And then Team Blue, that would be us, the good guys, so-called, will scramble 9 two-seater planes from the 36th Pursuit Squadron to intercept the, quote, enemy bombers and searchlights with the power of 800 million candles. Was that funny? What a great unit of measure. 800 million candle power will fill the skies over Farmingdale.
Out ahead of the Black Team members, a half dozen recon planes will drop parachute flares to light the target. And the instant Blue Team sees those flares, 4 3-inch guns from the 62nd Coast Artillery are to unload with blank ammo.
The bombers will make 2 runs above the target, dropping their fake loads once by flare light and once in darkness. Let's give a listen as things begin to heat up on the ground.
And now, Here at 10:32 is the warning order given by the Air Defense Commander, Brigadier General Frederick H. Martin of the 3rd Wing. To all defense establishments in the air defense area, the following message just received at Air Defense Headquarters from our warning net station at Lake Ronkonkoma. High-flying formation believed to be enemy bombers, now passing over, headed west. All defense establishments on the alert. All lights out in the air defense area. Go into action when the enemy appears. Pursuits, take off at once. And now we hear the sirens coming from atop the fire station over in Farmingdale, and we see the platoon of magnificent searchlights, 800 million candle power searchlights, shining up in the air, given three beams telling the people in Farmingdale and in that 5-mile area to turn off their lights and get ready. Now the planes are taking off. 9 pursuit planes. We've seen 1, 2. And now here goes the 4th and the 5th.
It's an exciting bit of radio. It's like, can you imagine sitting at home and not having anything happen like this even close to your backyard? And this is like a real regional event. It's kind of exciting.
And you'd have had a lot of those men that are sitting at home, and I picture them there smoking their pipe, kind of listening to this on the radio,
right,
who'd been through the Great War.
Yeah.
These magnificent lights shining up in the air, meeting each other high miles overhead. Now we see number 6 of the plane, followed by number 7, and the pursuit planes are quickly off in the air to defend this field. I want to call to your attention that Farmingdale is not being defended, but the attack tonight will be on the area housing these two great airplane factories. Now we see the planes go up over above us. Lights are all extinguished. No lights any place within this whole section of the country. And so now a real simulation of war as these planes go up overhead. Tonight, a beautiful and an ideal night for these maneuvers. Just a short time ago, Brigadier General Martin told us that it was a perfect night, a fine night for flying. And now we see the planes go up above, still flying with lights, getting ready now to meet the enemy. The enemy planes flying higher overhead.
It would be nice to know who this announcer is, where sometimes you just get these voices, as in our Pearl Harbor episode, that sort of come out of nowhere and recede into nowhere in history, and to wonder what his story was and his experience. Had he covered the war in London, any of these things? And he may have been feeling that when he makes a point to say that the factories are being targeted, not civilians.
Yeah, that was a big deal. They wanted all the articles leading up to the day. You know, the War Department always made a big deal that saying, you know, we don't contemplate, you know, civilian population area assaults. We're just, you know, we're just considering, you know, industrial target areas. So they just want to at least keep that, even though it was a fake theoretical line, they wanted to keep it there so people would really not get too freaked out. Of course, you know, as time went on, we knew civilian bombings became, you know, something that everybody did.
The audio starts to get a little funky once we go inside the bomber, as you might expect and as you can hear in the background. Remember, these guys, they need oxygen, they're flying up there, they have masks on. The reporter's initial soundbite describes a bit of what we covered about the black team's objective and how it would collect data about the fake bombing strikes. Let's listen to some of the color from the air that's a bit easier to understand.
We're up to the north of that dark area, which is surrounded by a fringe of lights representing motor cars and sightseers, perhaps on the highways around Farmingdale. A great throng of sightseers from New York and surrounding communities came out tonight to see this first air raid blackout drill in the history of the United States. We're still waiting to sight the flares, which will be dropped by the reconnaissance planes below us just as soon as they get near that particular spot that they want. Our two great motors here are spitting out blue flame, and we've climbed up to our prescribed height of 8,000 feet. We've been booming along at about 220 miles an hour, circling over this area for about 15 or 20 minutes, waiting for our other planes to catch up to us. As yet, no flares have been dropped. We're peering out of our window here in this navigator's seat, looking out over the broad expanse of this wing and waiting to see this demonstration. It was truly remarkable to see the lights snap out as one, and the searchlights of the 62nd Coast Guard artillery and go into action and warn the citizens of Farmingdale that this air raid was officially on. One can hardly imagine that this sort of thing is taking place in the United States, because, as we told you, it is the first time that such a maneuver has ever been held by the Army Air Corps. And it is the climax of these great maneuvers, which have... There goes the first flare now, dropped from the bomber over to our left. They're dropping down, several of them, and the parachutes are opening gently, and those flares are beginning to illuminate. And down on the ground, I'm sure that they can see them coming down. It looks like a whole building coming down. They're dropping out in twos, two flares at a time, as they're spewed out of the belly of one of these bombers flying alongside of us at about half a mile away. Now the string of light stretches out to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, a double row of 8 great magnesium flares, which drop and will illuminate that ground like daylight when they all are released. We can't quite sight the plane because she's flying without lights, but we can see the trail of huge flares going out behind it.
And one of the bits of data collection that they're referring to is that they wanted to be able to sort of get a sense of their objective. They weren't blowing things up in Farmingdale on Island for sure, but they were using high-powered cameras to capture views of the target area, and that would be part of their equation to declare effectiveness or lack of effectiveness. So, but just think about, like, hearing this, you know, and this guy is talking about seeing these magnesium flares, and you can hear the excitement in his voice. You know, you can just imagine what that would look like. You know, he said it looked like buildings coming down, because you can imagine it's like floor after floor, if you will, of these flares. And this must have been sort of thrilling. It's good radio, man. You know.
Yeah, they had a real job back then. Don't forget of how. They were really your eyes on the spot, and they had to paint pictures with their words. It was a much different job than it was today. You were describing what you saw live. Nowadays, we're used to, maybe you've been there. If you've been to Long Island then, or you've been to the World Trade Center, this was one thing that made 9/11 so real for so many people. You were able to fly and take a jet plane, and people visited the towers, and you connected with it. You saw it in a million movies and TV shows, and they wouldn't have done that then. They would have had some connection, but you needed someone to paint the pictures there. When you say the Hamptons, I would guarantee we have a much more vivid image of what that means than somebody who's in 1938, unless they've been there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
This was also only 35 years after the first flight, the Wright brothers, in 1903. So you think somebody our age, they would have, the age that we are today, they would have spent their whole childhood really without any airplanes, and now suddenly to be told, well, they can fly over and they're going to might drop bombs on us. It's just
right.
Just, and magnesium flares and all these things and all this candle power. They'd grown up with actual candles, real candles to light them. So it just must have been such a awesome spectacle to be involved in, even though it was frightening.
And this notion of you know, technological advancement, you know, especially during wars, I don't know what the how true it is, but one sort of number I always heard tossed around is that a war sort of moves a country's technology ahead, you know, 20 or so years. But so just imagine, though, things that they didn't even have in 1938 that by the time 1945 comes along, you know, it's just sort of insane to think how incredibly strong America got in that intervening period.
It certainly moves medicine forward.
Yeah.
That's one thing we were mentioning MASH there in passing, but those guys had to take some risks, obviously. If you have all these guys coming in, all these wounded, eventually we get things like penicillin and we get morphine and we get some ability to give you more than a bullet to bite on if you've been shot or having your arm or leg sawed off in the Civil War. It's something of obviously we'd rather not do, but it definitely does propel the technology forward.
Sure. All right, this is an interesting one coming up. You begin to get a sense, in passing mention, a taste of the geopolitical situation. Give a listen.
As yet, we haven't seen the flashes of the... There go the flashes of the anti-aircraft guns below down at Seversky Field, and they are trying to take sights on these invisible planes flying without lights. There go the flashes, and if you don't think this looks like China or Spain, you're crazy, because it does. My goodness, it is the United States.
That's what we referred to earlier about him sort of painting the world picture there about China and Japan, and there is a war going on out there, and they want people to know that they're trying to be prepared.
That's right. We're going to let this one breathe a little bit. This is more exciting stuff from the guy in the bomber who really has a front row seat to quite an insane show in the skies above Farmingdale.
There go more magnesium flares out of the bombers over to our left. And high above us at 15,000 feet, 7,000 feet above our location, alert those tremendous bombers similar to the one in which we're flying, which can drop 3,200 pounds of explosives on that objective, Seversky Field and its surrounding plants. His great planes weigh about 13 tons themselves and carry 3,200 pounds of explosives. There goes a great string of lights out now, falling gently. There's hardly any wind tonight, and they're dropping right over the town. And from here, we can see the town begin to take shape at this great height of 8,000 feet. Right off our wing now lies Farmingdale, a community which is on guard for this raid from the skies. And the great flares continue to spew out of those planes, dropping out of the giant belly underneath where bombs are normally carried. There are some 100 flares to be dropped. Just for a moment, we've lost sight of the searchlights and the anti-aircraft batteries. Now we do see them again. And the whole ground is lighted up just as if there were giant searchlights playing from the air. You can pick out that surrounding area very plainly. And I'm sure that the bombers high above us can take accurate sight through their bomb racks and take the photographs which will prove that the United States Army Air Corps is one of the most effective in the entire world. And should it be called upon to do this sort of work, it could do it. And it could repel such an invasion, just perhaps as these pursuit planes which took off from the field a few minutes ago could do. What a picturesque sight now, as these flares begin to drop faster toward the earth as they burn out and great streamers of smoke trail off behind.
Yeah, they're really pushing the idea to the public here, and they need to get the public on board that if needed, you know, the Army Air Corps is the best air force in the world and can do the tough work that hadn't really been tested at yet, you know?
Yeah, they're avoiding creating a panic. They're just trying to tell people who may very well be getting a little bit nervous reading these air reports out of Spain and out of China and watching Japan just storm across there. There's that shot in the Pearl Harbor episode that you cut into the intro where, I believe it's a congressman on the floor of the House, and he's saying, reminding Japan, we have a Navy in the Pacific.
We have a Navy in the Pacific, yeah. A mighty Navy. Yeah.
And gosh, so that's the thing. It's not for fun. Like when I listened to it, I said, people today might think, well, it sounds like a little bit fun, including us.
Exciting.
It sounds something a Guinness Book of World Record trying to set. Everybody turn their lights off at once, or you know, they do that Earth Day thing every year, and people to all turn off your lights, be part of something. But this could have very serious practical applications.
No, absolutely. As it turned out, it did. Mm. All right, we're going to want one last bit of sound from our man in the air as he signs off and gives us actually a little bit of tech info that made his live remote possible.
So far, no one has tried to put a searchlight on us, but the batteries are singing into action now. A slight motor of night, hardly the right time of the night for a raid at this time, because in a long time we'd be pretty observed up here. But you can practically sight on your attention from a long distance, and for that reason there would be a flyback for those flying up here. The best way to search it, there's no more of the lake, and that's just the best way to prove our description from up in the air. The passing condition of the Turkish fleet has been completed, and as these giant panthers swing away and vanish as quickly as they appeared, we conclude our broadcast from the sky. Brought to you through the shortwave relay broadcast transmitter of station WOR. We return you to Air Defense Headquarters for an official summary of the accomplishments of this raid, the first blackout and air raid drill in American history.
The shortwave relay broadcast transmitter. That's the only way it could have been done then. Okay, back on the ground and back to some crisp audio.
Yes, good old crisp audio. Yeah, so here's the official wrap up now. We've got the military guy in there, you know, and he's obviously reading off a card of some kind, but it's all sounding very on message.
We're back on the ground now with Defense Headquarters, and we're looking at these searchlights following the enemy planes as they go overhead. And they really have the spotlight on them, and the guns are shooting away at them. And so now that it looks like the enemy is vanquished, we're going to turn you over to the Chief of Staff of the GHQ Air Force, Colonel W.H. Frank, and have him tell us of the lesson that he believes has been learned in these maneuvers. Colonel Frank.
We believe that this first air raid drill, though conducted on a small scale, is a striking forward step in the national defense of this country. Anti-aircraft defense for several years has been a real concern of many European peoples. The tremendous advances in the range of aircraft in the last 2 years are at this very time making this problem of air defense a vital concern to us in this country. Farmingdale has had the distinction and the privilege of being the site for the first test in the United States, where civil populations have cooperated with the military forces in working out all the details of both active and passive air defense. Speaking for General Andrews, commanding general of the GHQ Air Force, I wish to thank the citizens in this area, which has been blacked out tonight, for their wholehearted cooperation and enthusiastic support of our problem in these tests. We have learned much. We know now the proportions of these problems. When once worked out and solved, they can be employed for the blackout of more extensive areas. We were wise, I feel, in limiting the first test to a relatively small area and a comparatively limited population. But the lessons learned can now be applied universally when need shall arise. One thing we have learned is that radio is an indispensable medium for the transfer of intelligence and information over a large cross-section of the population. Our warning signals were transmitted tonight by radio. The split-second promptness with which widely separated organizations and peoples met that warning with an instantaneous response indicates the effectiveness of radio in situations such as this. Our problem tonight concludes the GHQ maneuvers for the northeastern section of the United States for this year. Tomorrow we have a concentration of all our widely scattered units, and on Wednesday morning we start back for our home stations. We go in the knowledge that the 2 weeks' training we have had in this area will be of lasting benefit to the nation's air defense.
Our thanks to Colonel W.H. Frank, Chief of Staff of the GHQ Air Force. The lights of Farmingdale will soon begin to reappear, and the population return to normal routine following the first practice air raid and drill staged by the General Headquarters Air Force as a climax to the extensive five-day maneuvers of the United States Air Corps. The Mutual Network has described this exciting event from both land and sky. This broadcast has been a presentation of the Special Features Division. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
I love that. It's like, you know, hi, I'm your dry army guy.
You know? One thing about that that I've mentioned before, I always think of when I have Eisenhower. We ended the last episode that we did about Alice Ramsey with the Eisenhower soundbite. Is poor Ike, and it's not just him, it's anybody back then. You didn't grow up talking to a microphone like we were. You didn't really have it.
Well,
that was
right.
A crazy novelty.
Right. There's not media training in the same way that we have it now, where everyone, you know, where you can go and you can sit with, you know, in many cases, a former news anchor, you know, and they'll get you ready for whatever it is you're selling or you're pushing or your appearance. And, you know, some people just love to be on TV, you know, they get them ready for that. But yeah, it was a different world, absolutely different world. It's funny, I was keep thinking about this notion of an air raid and you know, where I live out in Los Angeles, in Los Angeles in general, there are still so many air raid sirens from the Second World War and the Cold War. I think there's something like 70% of them are still in place, which is amazing. This is also, you know, you see a lot of vintage cars out here because, just, you know, metal lasts longer in this environment. Mm. It's a constant reminder to me if I'm in my neighborhood taking a hike and I'll turn a corner and all of a sudden there will be one of these air raid sirens. And it's like, yeah, this was real. Mm. This was a real concern for so many people, you know. Mm. The blackout itself, though, apparently worked very well. One pilot reported that Farmingdale, quote, might just as well have been a wheat field in the middle of Texas, end quote.
Meaning how dark it was, huh?
Oh, yeah.
So there it is. Pretty cool little archival nugget giving us a sense of where we were in May 1938 and where we were heading into an increasingly dangerous world.
Yeah, and of course, you know, these mimic wars and drills would continue here at home and take on greater importance after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely. And along those lines, we're going to return to this subject and the subject you were just talking about in a few weeks and focus on the so-called Battle of Los Angeles of February 1942, when something was seen over the skies in L.A. that triggered a full-scale anti-aircraft response from a city in the throes of what were war jitters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we'll be headed to Fort MacArthur here in L.A. and join in the anniversary festivities, including a recreation of the raid, live period music, dancing, food, and drinks. I'm psyched.
It sounds like it's going to be awesome. I look forward to the pictures.
Yep.
And if you're in the area on February 21st and want to check out what sounds like a fantastic day of history and fun, head to ftmac.org for tickets and information, or you can call 1-310-548-2631.
Yeah, I'll be there too. I'm going to wear some sort of giant hat that says Angry History, although we don't have those, do we? I don't know.
No, okay. Face tattoo.
Yeah, face tattoo. Oh, gosh, face tattoo. Yeah, I finally got my Romney one off, you know. But, But anyway, yeah, I'm really excited for it, and the folks over at Fort MacArthur do a bang up job of not just of throwing a great bash, but you know, keeping this fresh in people's minds. I mean, this was there will be, you know, survivors there, you know, who were children at the time, of course.
Great, sounds good.
Yeah, I'm so psyched for this thing. It's going to be a lot of fun, and the folks at Fort MacArthur really do a bang up job of maintaining the memory of this event, which is, you know, for me, it was something that just was not in my wheelhouse before I moved out here. You know, I was so anti LA for so many reasons, and I just wasn't even allowing things like this in. But like I said, when you're walking around and you see an air raid siren or you have an event that you can sort of have as a touchstone, like what they're doing at Fort MacArthur, it's really valuable. It's easy to forget, you know, what happened in this country and the true day-to-day fears about attacks on the homeland. And you know, we certainly have some context for that now. But yeah, that's where we'll be on the 21st.
Looking forward to it.
All right, in the meantime, guys, thanks for tuning in today. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you next time.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.